applied for continuing education, you will receive a certificate verifying your participation. Our presenter for today is Rita Nichols, RN, Executive Director of Lutherans in Medical Missions and a true friend and supporter of parish nursing. She has an extensive history in medical missions abroad and work with refugee and immigrant populations in the United States. And would you join me for prayer? Lord, you have told us to go into the world to share the good news of your love with all people. You have even brought the world to our doorsteps so that we may serve others in your name without leaving home. Be with us today as we learn from Rita's experience and expertise and consider ways we can reach out with Christ's healing love to others. In Jesus' name, amen.
Thank you, Marcy, and hello, everyone. I have extensive experience in everything but how to get my webcam to work. All of a sudden, it's just not there, and I apologize for that, and I'm so sorry you can't see my lovely face, but I'm just gorgeous, and I just picture the most attractive woman you can, and just imagine that's me. So I'm so honored to be able to do this with you today. And we did entitle this webinar, Missionaries Without Passports. But the more I thought about it, the more I prepared and the more I prayed, I realized that's not the right title because we're just plain missionaries with and without passports. Because although this webinar is, the intent of it is to focus on how to reach out to our immigrant and refugee populations here in the United States, it's really all about how to reach out to anyone because everyone is involved in the harvest. Our whole country is a harvest field. Whether they're people that have lived here for their entire lives or just got off a plane from a refugee camp in Liberia or Syria. So we're just all missionaries, and that's what I want to talk about today and one way to do that. And when I put a quote here from Matthew 38 to talk about the harvest, and after I did that, I wish that I would have used the harvest reference that when Jesus talks about the harvest in John 4, because I love that image, and I want you to just think about it for a second with me, if you could. Jesus had just finished talking to the Samaritan woman, and she had left her water jar and ran off into the village to bring all the other Samaritans of the village to meet Jesus, and because she told them, "He told me everything about myself. Come and meet him." And just as she's left and she's in the process of telling them, the disciples are coming back to Jesus who's at the well because they went into the town of Samaria, the Samaritan town, the hated, dreaded Samaritan town, to find some food for him. And they see him sitting there and they start to talk about food and did you already eat and what's going on. And they're talking and he's in his loving, always patient, kind way of saying, "I have food to eat that you don't know about. My food is to do the will of God," and he goes on and about that. And then he says, "Do you not say that it's 4 or 5 months to the harvest?" In other words, don't count your chickens before they're hatched. But he said, "I tell you, look up. The harvest is ripe." And that's the vision I want you to see. Just as he's looking up, just as he tells them to look up, all these Samaritans have come back to talk to Jesus. And the disciples look up and they see all these strange, unfamiliar people, a group of people that they don't even want to have any kind of talk with. They have no, they're not Jewish. They're unclean. They've got everything confused in their worldview and in their spiritual life. And here Jesus is saying, "This is your harvest." So I love that. I love that. So think about that when you think about the harvest. I am Rita Nichols. My name is Marguerite, but I go by Rita, and you can see there all the things that I've done and the places that I've been. And like many of you, I've done all kinds of nursing, but most of it has been focused on public and community health for the last maybe 25, 30 years. And I was a medical missionary in Kyrgyzstan. And the picture that I chose has my best Kyrgyz friend in the whole world beside me, although she's Russian, Lena, who has been side by side with me since the beginning of the century, working and developing a community health education program, which is CHE, which we will talk about, that is not only working in Kyrgyzstan till this day, but it has been replicated in LCMS mission fields and all over in Central Asia, in Southeast Asia, South and Latin America, many, many places, and also many other organizations use this. Many, many others use it. And I'm also the executive director, and I do want to get this in, of Lutherans Medical Missions. And Lutherans Medical Missions works with local and global partners to share Christ's healing in medically underserved communities. And we're very involved, and we want to be even more involved with helping others develop community health education programs and projects as an outreach to build a bridge for the gospel in their communities, not only abroad, but here in the United States. And please check out our website, lim@lim.org, because the telephone number on the website is my phone number, and I'd love to talk to you and help you in any way I can. And like us on Facebook. We're on Facebook, Lutherans and Medical Missions. Please look, please like us, and get. And anytime you need me, I'm right here. Okay. Now, because the focus is missionaries without passports, we want to talk a little bit about refugees and immigrants. And I purposely put this on because I had to work that out in my mind. I had to sort of make sure I understood the difference. So a refugee is, and forgive me, I want to make this right now. You probably could teach this, many of you that are listening, better than I. So if I'm redundant and if I repeat things you already know, I'm just excited about it. And please forgive me for that. So a refugee is a person who's been persecuted and often victimized in their own countries on the basis of all sorts of things. Usually it's race or religion or ethnicity. And I said that, and I don't think I said it wrong, belonging to certain social groups or having certain political opinions and who've crossed the border to another country. So refugees, and they don't just come to America, do they? They come to countries. When I was in Guinea, West Africa, and there was a Liberian refugee camp very near the village where I was staying because there had been civil war in Liberia. In Kyrgyzstan, in the beginning of the century, we had lots of refugees coming from Afghanistan. And now Turkey has well over almost 2 million refugees crossing the border from Syria. So every country at one time or other has received refugees, as opposed to immigrants. And an immigrant is a person, no, we're talking about legal immigrants right here, who relocates to a new country because they want to and have approval from the new country's government. And they can return to their country of origin without fear. They want to come. They want a better life. And when I think of immigrants, I think of that old picture of the boat and seeing the Statue of Liberty and everybody coming to Ellis Island. But we don't have that picture now of immigrants, do we? We have a picture of an unprotected border in the south of our country. We have a whole different worldview of what immigrants are. But nevertheless, they are all, whether they're legal or illegal, for whatever reason they've come, for whatever reason refugees have come, they're here. And they are a harvest field. Just put this, and we won't dwell on this, but I wanted to just, for interest, and the latest little list like this that I could pull up was from 2012. I'm sure there are more recent ones. The countries where countries of origin of U.S. refugees. You can see they're from all over the place, but they also have a pattern, don't they? And the top 10 states, again, in 2012, accepting refugees. And if you look at that list, Texas, California, some in Michigan and Pennsylvania, Georgia, Florida, Ohio, Arizona, Washington, Carolina, North Carolina, you can see that it covers the whole country, doesn't it? And now, more than ever, more and more refugees are flooding to the Midwest, in places, particularly in places like Nebraska, South Dakota, Iowa, just so many, many, many. I was in Omaha, and there's a huge refugee population there. Lincoln, so much work is beginning in Lincoln with refugees and with immigrants. So it's all over, and there's a blank one right there, so we're just going to go right on. What was supposed to be there was sort of just to give you a feel of where, a map of the country. So visualize a map of the country. And for this point, at this stage, just visualize, like you're visualizing me in all my beauty, dressed here in an evening gown. Just visualize our whole country just bursting, and white with the harvest. Carlos Fuentes is a Mexican essayist and poet and novelist, I think. And I like this quote. Carlos wrote, "Recognize yourself in he and she who are not like you and me." And I do not believe that when Carlos wrote this, he meant what I take from that and what I hope and I know in my heart that you take in that. Because Jesus wants us to recognize, and we should as his children, recognize in he and she who are not like you and me, his love, a child for whom Christ died, a sinner, a person who Jesus visualized on the cross when he died, because he died for the sins of the whole world, who needs him, and who he yearns to use us to bring into his kingdom through the power of his Holy Spirit. Now, thinking about our country right now, and that map that it's not there, but I want you to visualize in every state, everywhere, people coming in from other countries, but also a country that is changing, even if nobody came from another country to it, because demographics are changing. Inner cities are encroaching on the city and the better parts of the city. The better parts of the city are going out to the suburbs. The suburbs are going out into farming communities. And we're changing. And there's a song. Do you remember that song? "Doesn't anyone stay in just one place anymore?" I would burst in song, but then you'd all get off this webinar faster than I. It would be horrible. So I'm only going to say it. "Doesn't anyone stay in one place anymore?" No. No, they really usually don't stay in one place anymore. We have children. We have four children. They live in New York, New Jersey, Paris, France, in New Orleans. And that's not, and we're down here, we live in an over 55 community in St. Augustine, Florida, south of Jacksonville. Rarely do people stay in one place anymore. Children go where there are jobs. Families go where there are jobs. We're scattered. And it's just not the way it used to be. So is it any surprise that congregations find themselves in uncharted territory these days? Because everything is shifting. And we, as parish nurses, as health educators, as children of God, are called to reach out into that strange, shifting territory with witness, mercy, and life together. And there are tons of ways to do this, and almost all of them are valuable. I probably should have said all are, because I can't really think of one that doesn't have some merit to it. But to reach out, to be in a congregation that suddenly, or maybe not so suddenly, but simply starts to wake up to the fact, hey, I don't think this is Kansas anymore, Toto, except it could very well be Kansas. So you say, I don't think this is the Kansas it was 20 years ago, Toto, or even 10 years ago. To be able to wake up to that and to do something about it, it's spooky. Now, I want to share one way, one simple lesson plan, one concept that I believe parish nurses can use to take a step to help their congregation, whether that congregation is going to be reaching out into the new neighborhood where they live, or whether there are members in that congregation that feel called and led to take a mission trip, a short-term mission trip somewhere. Perhaps there's a pastor that you're supporting, and you just feel like God's calling them. They're feeling that God's calling them. What do we do when we get there? This is a way. One tool that I believe that particularly parish nurses can take, holding the hands of both new neighbors and congregational members, bringing them together and working together for the harvest. Because, you know, I really do believe that our congregations want very much to help. And to me, that church, I found it, and it's a Lutheran church. I Google Lutheran churches online. Reminds me of a church I knew in Rochester, New York, that was a smack dab in the middle of the inner city. And it was an aging congregation. And they just grew smaller and smaller and smaller and smaller. And just sort of, I just envisioned this spider web just sort of gently weaving itself. And if any of you are from Rochester, forgive me. Weaving itself around that church until it was just covered. And just, I don't even know what the building's used for anymore, because it just, nobody had a vision, or if they did have a vision, there was no one there to say, give them any kind of tools to reach out into the middle of that city that was not the city it used to be, and the congregation moved, and they sold the building, And I just pray and I hope that God is using whatever congregation is there now to work. But that congregation wanted to help. There was just nobody to show them the way to help. There are lots of ways. And I don't even think we need to go over all these kind of ways, because we've all known, and probably all of you involved in some kind of outreach ministry. So there's clothing and food shelters, and there's so much of this going on in the States right now. It's so exciting. English is a second or foreign language, transportation, counseling, hooking people up and taking them to pastoral counseling or other kinds of counseling, sponsoring families. I remember when we were in Scranton, Pennsylvania, in the mid-70s, we had, and I was a young mom and with four little kids, my husband was a pastor, we had a Laotian gentleman stay with us when he first came over. And the thing I remember most, and probably the first lesson I ever had in worldview, was when we were sitting in Scranton, Pennsylvania, and we were at a friend's house, and they had a cottage on a lake, and there were hills on the other side of the lake. And he looked out, and he said, "Are there lions? No, tigers. Are there tigers in the hills?" And I thought, we said, no. And then as I thought back on this, why wouldn't he think there were tigers on those fields? He got on a plane in Laos. He got off of it in Scranton, Pennsylvania. He had no idea what we were like, what was going on. And why would he not think that there were tigers in those hills? There were tigers in his hills. So there's all sorts of things going on, and I digress. But there's all sorts of ways that we are helping new neighbors. I want to talk about one really neat way. And this poem is a development poem. It's used in community health education development classes and training sessions all over the world by those that are training the trainers. And I love it. Go in search of your people. It means go find them. Don't wait for them to come to you. Go out into the community. And again, there's not enough time to talk about how to do that. But there are ways that there's no, it won't happen without blood, sweat, and tears, because you won't know the people if you don't go out to the people. And if that means if they're from wherever they're from, if they're from Africa or South America or Georgia, moving to somewhere else, wherever they're from, you have to go in search of them. Jesus went in search of the Samaritan woman. She then went in search of her village, of her fellow villagers. He searched for us. So we go out and search. And then we love the people that we found. We love them just as they are, because we recognize in he or she, who is not like you and me, a person for whom Jesus Christ died. And we serve them. We serve them in any way we can. We pray to find ways to serve them. And development key, we begin with what they have. And everybody has something. Everybody has a life that they have lived, experiences, and wisdom. Build on what they know, not on what they think that we think they should know, not on what we want them to know, but what they know right this minute. But with the best of leaders, when the task is accomplished, the people all remark, "We have done it ourselves." And that is the key. That is what makes community health education, or the CHE concept that we're going to be building on and talking about and ending today with the lesson plan for, different. Because it's about empowering. It's about equipping and reproduction. It's taking a screening clinic for blood pressure, for hypertension, or for diabetes, just a few steps further, by then adding on to that an interactive lesson that those that are participating can go out and model and pattern in their home and teach their neighbors. And you can take by the hand and say, "You've learned this lesson. Now let's go out together. And I'll be with you when you share this with your neighbors." So it becomes something that those we are training and teaching and want to reach can truly say, "We have done it ourselves." So what is CHE? What in the world am I talking about? Well, I found out about CHE in 2003 when I was in Kyrgyzstan, Central Asia, I was a nurse. My husband was a pastor. There was another nurse and a pastor there, Bob and Sue File. There was a medical trailer, a wonderful one from Orphan Grain Train here in the States, and Sue was responsible for that. That was her heart, and she loved that. And I had just spent several years in community and public health, and so when we were offered a grant, and basically our bosses said, we want to do something here. Find out what people need. Find out what the women need. So I went on the van one day, and we'd only been there a year or two, and I asked, what do you think we need? Well, I asked the doctor on the van. The van served children of childbearing age. Well, fooey on that. Women of childbearing age and children. It was a medical, it had a dentist that treated kids, and then an OBGYN and a pediatrician. So I asked the OBGYN and the pediatrician. They say, our women in the villages need to know more about their bodies. They need more to know more about what to eat because we have far too many infants. Our infant mortality rate is high. We have far too many women become too ill in pregnancy. We have far too many deaths in pregnancy and premature births that lead to death. So I started in my mind trying to figure out where I could go, and I found online medical ambassadors. And medical ambassadors had been in, I knew that they had medical missionaries, but I knew very little more about them. Am I changing? Yeah, there. Very little about them. So they were having a training the trainer course in Russia. I went to the course. I learned all about Che, and I learned to love. Why does that keep changing? To love what's going on in Che. Community, so that's how I got involved. And we built it from there, and we grew it until now. God grew it. Until now, in Kyrgyzstan, this is a strong program with many, and you can see the women there, some of them that work in this, that have worked in this maybe a few years, a few months, or a decade, to go out into their villages and their communities and reaching women, helping them to develop better, healthier lives to themselves and their families, building bridges to the gospel, praying with them, and empowering them to reach other women. It's a holistic outreach strategy, and it integrates evangelism, discipleship, and church planning with community health and development. And we, today, and in Kyrgyzstan, we stuck with the health education part and then worked with the church, and that's the deacon of the church there, Pastor Kenjibek, in bringing pastors and lay pastors to come then when the time was right. But always there was the gospel, because this is a program, these lessons were the gospel and the good news of Jesus Christ. Or even if you're in a congregation and you want to use some catechism, whatever, can be seamlessly interwoven into it. So that's what it is. And Jay, you've got the website there that you can go online and look. It's just got some wonderful materials. You have to be able to access a lot of the materials. You have to have gone to one of the conferences. But I've gone to the conferences, and I'll be glad to talk to you about them anytime. The lessons that we're going to talk about can be taught and shared by everyone. This is a cute little Sweetie Pie in Chile, whose apartment was destroyed in the 2010 quake, and who lived in a displaced persons camp. And we went to Chile, a couple of us, with LIM and MMT, LCMS, Mercy Medical Teams, but mostly at that point it was LIM, I believe. But we went to train some local workers, one nurse, some deaconesses, and some volunteers from Argentina, and Lutheran volunteers from Argentina and Chile, that wanted to do something, reach out into this camp and into the whole area that had been affected by this earthquake. So after a while, we went to the camp, and the gals that we had been, the women, never mind gals, that the women that we had been teaching learned the concepts and taught kids how to clean and wash their hands using finger paints, so that you know how to use proper, how to get them totally clean instead of just a little bit clean. And then this little girl, because it was taught in a way that she could understand, was going to go and teach other children how to do that. So they can be taught and shared by everyone, and I mean everyone. Congregations, people in your congregations with no health experience at all, that have absolutely no idea what to do, can begin to use this ministry. But they can learn simple lessons, they can build relationships, and they can be a part of this. And they can take those lessons into the community with someone from that they've met in that community, or they can take them on a mission trip. And it really works. I know it works. Everybody gets into the act. This is a volunteer from Argentina working in Chile, working with children at that camp, teaching them. Now, they're a little young to teach over. But those taught become teachers, and they begin to take ownership. This is the most powerful part of it. It's one thing to have a health class, and I am in no, they are wonderful. And I've done a lot of them. And I've gone to clients' homes, patients' homes, and taught. I've done it. And it's one thing to do a health fair and a blood pressure screening and talk about diabetes. It's all wonderful. But to another level, another entirely different thing, when those taught become the teachers, buy into it and share it, become the teachers, and take what they've learned into their homes, into their community, gather other people together, usually women, because it's, my experience has been women teaching women, because it was from a Muslim country, and that's just how it worked, and that's what I'm familiar with. But this model can be used with anybody. But taking it to their communities and teaching others and letting it grow, all the while, as believers, using it as a bridge to the gospel and using it as ministry. With ownership, when they own it, when we have done it ourselves, other good things follow, other kind of community development things. These women are beautiful sisters in Christ who live in a small village in the smack dab in the middle of Central Asia in the country of Kyrgyzstan. And they had gone to some classes for several years and became healthcare educators. They call them women's issues leaders right now. And they learned and they teach others. And they know, and they went to their village, and they really got things going in that village in all sorts of ways, because self-efficacy, you know, women started to develop self-efficacy and feel good about themselves, and they decided to take on a project and paint each other's homes. And so they were painting each other's homes. And the whole community brightened. And not only were they doing that, but they were bringing the gospel to those people in ways that nobody else had ever been able to do, because they were women talking to women. But someone has to take charge of this. And I learned this not long ago when we did a workshop. And it was a workshop in a community where there was a whole brand new population of immigrants and refugees. Some of them just literally off the plane from a refugee camp. And they were so excited, and they had an opportunity to work. They had a building. And I come, and a couple of us from Lynn went, and we gave a program, and we talked about the very things I'm talking about. But sadly, what we had not fleshed out, we thought we had, but we really hadn't, was there anyone that could take charge? After we did this, was there anyone that could catch that vision and take it to the next level? And sadly, there wasn't, because there was no parish nurses. And while there might have been a couple health professionals, it was not what they could do at that point. So somebody, for it to work, somebody has to take charge. And look at you guys, there you are at Concordia University. Aren't you pretty? You are. And look at Marcy. Parish nurses can teach and train church members how to teach and train their new neighbors. And they can also teach and train church members how to go on a short-term mission trip and teach and train those that they minister to on that mission trip. And we're not talking brain surgery. We're talking simple health and wellness concepts that really make a difference. Somebody has to do it. And I love parish nurses. I think you guys, you women and men, I keep saying guys and ladies, but your men and women are one of the most amazing resources that the Lord has put on the earth for such a time as this. If God had not called my husband, who took me dragging, kicking, and screaming to Central Asia in 1998, I am sure that at this point in my life, I would be a parish nurse, because I always had that intention. And I just can't say enough wonderful things about you. And I know God has so many wonderful things he wants to do, has done, will continue to do, and even new avenues he wants to use for you. Together, Congregations and parish nurses can reach outside of themselves and into the lives of their new neighbors. This is the displaced person camp in Chile. And the gal, the woman with the red hair is a deaconess. The woman with the blue hood is a volunteer, not in any way medical, from Argentina, who has come to hear us talk about how to do community health education in this manner. Talking to one of the women who lost her home, who is living at the camp on her way to brush her teeth because they didn't always have access to all of that. It was much more convenient to go to a specific place where they had running water to do that. And they're finding out from her, what do you see you need? What happens here? Learning from them instead of sitting back and thinking, we're going to do this. And I did this. I know I'm not the only person that does this. I'm going to this displaced person camp. I know what it's like to be in a displaced person camp, to see it. I've seen them. I know what they need. And I'm going to go there and help them meet that need and tell them how to fix that need. No. I've done it and I repent of it. But before we begin that process, we have to say a few words about worldview. And why is this so important? Well, first of all, what is worldview? And I like the example that I've read about so many times, and you probably have heard too, that our worldview is like the lenses through which we see the world that frames everything about our world. It's a theory of the world, because we have to have a theory of the world, don't we? Otherwise, what would it be like? It would be like a constant state of disorientation. We would not know how to negotiate our environment. We wouldn't know how to negotiate a relationship. We would be just constantly disoriented, floating, just a ship without a rudder or a sail. If those are even good analogies, I'm not a sailor. So a worldview is a theory of the world that's used for living in the world, because we have to have it. We said that. It's a mental model of reality. The framework of ideas and attitudes about the world, about ourselves, about life. It's comprehensive. It's a whole system of beliefs, including our religious beliefs, very importantly, as Christians, including our religious beliefs, with answers for a wide range of questions so we know where we fit, whether we live in the middle of Africa, in a forest in Guinea, West Africa, or Omaha, Nebraska, in a neighborhood community, or an over 55 retirement community outside of St. Augustine, Florida. Wherever we live, we have to have a worldview that answers questions for why we live there. Now, why is this so important, and why am I going to talk about it? Well, I'm going to talk about it because all cultures use their worldview to explain health, to explain everything, but to explain health and wellness, death and dying, disease, how people catch disease, culture, and their worldview explains all of it. And the extent to which an individual perceives health and wellness information, and this is in any form, how they perceive that information as being relevant to their worldview has a profound effect on their willingness to listen and learn. I'm going to repeat that for myself as well as for you. All cultures have worldviews to explain everything, but certainly all issues of health and wellness. And the extent to which an individual, any of us, perceives whatever information we're given, and that includes health and wellness information, in any form, as being relevant to their worldview, as being relevant, has a profound effect on their willingness to listen and take action on what they've learned. Now, we all know this. I got a master's in my 50s in health education. This was beat into my brain. If we have to perceive that something that we learn is worth learning and worth the sacrifices it's going to take to put into action before we'll do it. Because if all we had to do was tell people and give them the list and go on and on and on, which I have done in my career, about why you shouldn't smoke, why you can't eat those pork rinds, if that's all we had to do was give them the information, then my goodness, the world would be a different place, wouldn't it? Nobody would smoke. Nobody would overdrink. Nobody would overeat. There would be no trans fats. It would just be a far different world. It doesn't work, and we know that. So that's why we have to talk about worldview. And I learned about worldview not by being a community health nurse in Rochester, New York, because that's where I live, and I knew the worldview there. I learned about worldview by baptism in a baptism by fire in the middle of Central Asia, as all expats, either missionaries or teachers or business people, whatever. When you find yourself plopped down in the middle of another culture, you have to come to terms with it. You have to learn about another. You have to get outside of yourself, and you'll never totally understand another culture. But you have to do. You have to begin to understand it and understand how it impacts not only the people that you're working with, but you, or you're going to go home. You're not going to make it. But it's perfectly possible to go on a tour or a cruise, a river cruise, or a tour of Europe, or even any other country, and keep your own eyeglasses through which you view the world tightly on your face. You don't need to learn it. And my fear, and as I'm, not my fear, my growing awareness of life is the fact that I think part of the problem in congregations today is that nobody has to think about, nobody thinks about their worldview. Now, a lot do, and I don't want to make blanket statements. And I know that there's agencies and there's people out there working, just doing fantastic jobs. But I also think there are places and people that have never looked outside their worldview. They've just never had to. It's getting harder in America because we're a changing place, and everybody's different, and everybody moves. And we're all different in our worldview. We're all Americans. I grew up in Columbus, Ohio. I finished high school and went to college in St. Louis, Missouri. I met my husband when he graduated from seminary. We moved to New York State. We lived in a small town. We lived in a big town. We moved to Scranton, Pennsylvania, Philadelphia, and ended up in Rochester, New York. From there, we went to Kyrgyzstan and Turkey, and now we live in Florida. And my worldview is just not the same as it was 5 years ago, which wasn't the same as it was seven, eight years before that. Our worldviews are impacted by where we live, and they change. My father's worldview, a World War II vet who went through the Depression, was never the worldview that I had. But there certainly were things in common. And we look through our worldview. We don't look at our worldview. Putin looks through a far different worldview than Gandhi, right? And I'm sort of like Putin. That's one thing that changed about my worldview. Live in a country for a decade where he is like the most revered person ever, and you see his face on television, and everything you hear about it is good. I kind of like the guy. So my worldview changed that way. But Gandhi and Putin certainly had a different worldview. Lincoln and Robert E. Lee, and certainly Hitler and Bonhoeffer, did not look through the same worldview, did they? Not for a minute. And our worldview is determined by what we see, not by what is seen. And I purposely did this because this really impacted me. On my left, as I look at it, is a Turkish, we call them, but they're really just Central Asian outhouse bathroom. It doesn't have a seat. And on my right is a very clean, hygienic Western commode. It's not particularly a beautiful picture, but it's a commode and it's clean. Now, I look at that and I see one thing. I would certainly rather be in that commode. I would fix it up a little bit because it's pretty boring, but it's the way you go to the bathroom. You sit on that seat, you go to the bathroom, probably wipe it first, but you sit on it. My friends, many of my friends in Central Asia who live in a village or even sometimes in the city, would far rather prefer that outhouse. Just hands down. And they would say, why would you want to go to the bathroom in the same place you, so close to where you eat and sleep and talk? Why would you do that? And why would you want to sit on a seat where other people have sat. It's the most unhygienic thing they can think of. So they love to have bathrooms outside, and they move them when they have to. They're out in nature. So our worldview determines what we see, not what there is to be seen. Now, I may still have a soft spot in my heart for Putin, but I gladly give up the outhouse. I'm perfectly content to sit on that commode and go potty. However, I had people when we lived in Kyrgyzstan would stand on my toilet and go to the bathroom because they couldn't sit. So it's all different. Now, I don't know why I have Oprah. I don't have a clue what Oprah's worldview is. I don't even want to go to where Oprah's worldview is. But I don't think Oprah, and I know I am not always aware that our worldview is there. We don't think about it because it's just who we are. It's how we see the world. I like this picture because worldview is a set of assumptions that helps us to interpret what we see. Now, it's an assumption, again, like the toilet, the two toilets. Who would want to use an outhouse? Of course, it's just there to maybe make a funny joke or something. Of course, we're going to go in the bathroom. So my assumption when I look at that is it's a bird. It's a bird. It's probably a parrot of some kind. And you've probably all seen this because this has been around for a while. But if you look closer, it's not a bird at all, is it? It's a woman in full body paint that looks like a bird. And there are lots of optical illusions like this, aren't there? And we have to understand that we interpret what we see through a set of assumptions that we have through our worldview. And my assumptions sometimes of what I see is not the same as my Southern Baptist friend's assumptions when we go to Bible class together in our community. And it's not the same as somebody that now lives in New Jersey. All of us have different assumptions, but some of our assumptions are more different than others. We're going to talk about briefly here, because I'm keeping an eye on the time, of the three basic types of worldview. Now, again, why is it important? Because our worldview is going to impact how we perceive any kind of information that is given to us and perceive what kind of need we have for information. Guilt, innocence. I'm going to go a little faster here so we get through this. We are a guilt, innocent culture here in the United States and in Europe. Our schools are focused on deductive reasoning, cause and effect, good questions, and process. Issues are very often seen as black and white, right and wrong. Written contracts are paramount. And aren't they? We are so litigious, for one thing. And you have to sign, I have to sign, probably 6 pieces of paper before I can even go have blood drawn at the lab. We are so wrapped up in this thing. Communication is direct and it can be blunt. We don't see that. And we may be okay on the phone. Hello, how are you? I'm fine, how are you? And that's it. And we know we have to say those things. And then you get to the point. And if you don't get to the point, you're getting a little anxious. Come on, come on, come on, come on, come on, come on, hurry. There's right, there's wrong. There's good, there's bad. And bad is bad whether it's seen or not. That's how we live. Good guys, bad guys. Shame, honor culture. And this is the culture that I believe we smack up against the worst, the hardest. In a shame, honor culture, and that's Asia and Southeast Asia, parts of North Africa, parts of South America. We all sort of know exactly what this culture looks like. We don't understand it. I don't understand it. Perhaps you do. But I lived with it for 10 years, and I know I butted up against it and caused a lot of grief. In a shame, honor-focused culture, individuals make honorable choices. That is not bad, necessarily, if nobody sees it, according to the situation they find themselves in. Communication, interpersonal interaction, and business dealings are very relationship-driven. I lost my place here. Just a second. With every interaction having an effect on the honor-shame status of the person. So it's not guilt, whether or not a law has been broken, but shame as seen by themselves and others. Everything has to be, you have to keep honor for yourself, but for also the person that you're talking about. There are rituals. Conversation is a dance. It doesn't go quickly. When you ask somebody You always start with tea, and sometimes when you have a dinner, you have a feast that you can ill afford, because that's how you honor. And in that culture, sometimes to us, it seems like people are, quit beating around the bush, let's just get to the point. And sometimes it seems like lying. I've had many experiences of that in Central Asia. But I also remember the very first time I ever took a mission trip, we were in India the year before we moved, in 1998 moved in 97, we went to India. And I was with somebody on the trip, and we had to go to the bathroom so bad. And we stopped in this building, and we asked the person, is there a bathroom, a restroom we could use? Yes, of course there is. You just go down that hall and another hall and then another one, and you'll find it. We went, we looked, there was no bathroom in the whole building. And we thought, why would they lie to us? Why in the world would they tell us there was a bathroom here when there wasn't? To save face. To keep you happy, and because it would be shameful to admit that there was no bathroom. Now, this is just a very short little description of this, but you can see right now how this would really impact communication if we didn't understand that. And it's this culture. The next one we're going to talk about isn't so hard to understand. But shame on her. After a decade living with it, I still look back and I shudder when I think of the shame. I brought shame to the people I walked down the street with because I wore ugly Birkenstocks. And if my husband would make a mistake in what he said, which we would just accept, I could see the horror on their faces because he brought shame to himself, and it was so unpleasant for them to see. So it's fascinating. And it's vital to begin to understand these things. Just briefly, a fear power culture, and we're familiar with this. This is a lot of the Middle East, parts of South America, Africa. I put a picture where the spirit world is very real. Haiti, for instance, and much effort is spent appeasing powers that may harm, or appealing to powers that may address the individual's needs by giving control over harmful spirits. So you understand what I'm saying. I saw a lot of this because this was in Asia. I used the symbol to rebel the evil eye because it's very real. In many parts of the world, spirits and evil eyes and putting a curse on somebody are real. And people you may meet believe those things. And you can't just say that's nonsense. This is not scientific. It's part of their worldview and their culture. So you put those little buttons, everything you buy, everything you get in Turkey has one of those little evil eye things on it. It's a little pin or a sticker or something. You have to be very careful what you buy because it's painted into a lot of the pottery because that wards off an evil eye because a person could be coming down the street and look at you and look at you have a beautiful child and look at that child and put a curse on that child. So you can't, you got to have that evil eye. So you don't walk down the street saying, what a beautiful child that is. You just learn what you can and can't do. Fear power culture also impacts businesses. When I think of fear culture, I think of big organizations, the army, the military. So and we all have part of all of those. Okay, now that we have that straight, let's talk about how it works. Okay, we're going to talk. I'm out of breath. I hope you're not out of breath listening. About the La Paz teaching approach. And this is the teaching approach that is used in the lesson plans that I'm going to be talking about. It's an acronym for a participatory teaching approach. And the focus is on the learner, not the teacher. The teacher / trainer, because that's really what you're doing. Is training the trainers, is there to draw out information every bit as much or more as it is to give input. And you can see those little chilly kids just going to town. And in its infant stage, which was in the mid-70s, or the early 70s actually, medical ambassadors, when they were beginning this whole community health education, holistic approach to going into communities and empowering the community to prevent dependency, which is always an issue, dependency, here in this country and certainly on mission fields. To prevent that, began to use this teaching style in their training classes. And you can look up medical ambassadors and research this for yourself because it's fascinating. So the past teaching method to begin, first is learner-centered. And you again with that poem. You start where learners are. You see what they learn, what they see the problem is. Because we're all most likely change if we understand and recognize the problem and take ownership of it. All of us do that so much easier and do it much better. Those were just so in this kind of class, and this is why you have to know your culture. You take time for greeting. You sit in, now this varies, and you're going to play with this however you want. But when you can, you sit in a circle. They do that in Kyrgyzstan, but they sit around a table because they sit on tables. The Russians do, but in a Kyrgyz village, they sit on the floor because Russians use tables and chairs. They're a platform society. The Kyrgyz people very often would prefer to be on the floor with no shoes. So whatever suits your group, that's how you sit. Smaller groups are best and easier for remembering names so that the teacher can learn to call people by names. Now, that takes time, and I'm assuming that by the time you're starting a class, you've done a whole lot of other work to get ready for that. Everyone contributes something to every discussion, if possible. These ladies are going through found a Russian atlas in St. Petersburg. I brought home with them for St. Petersburg, Russia. Brought home one time for them. So they're going over some stuff. And if there are questions or problems, they're brought up by the class. If there are questions or problems brought up by the class, they can be referred back to the learners for buzzing in small groups. That's so much better than answering it, even if it's a simple answer to the question. And even if you know exactly how you would answer it, send them back to talk about it. Talk about it. If it really is a question or a problem and somebody doesn't understand it, then let them work it out as they can and let them come up with the answer. Because this encourages the group to think and to share personal ideas. And these are some folks, some women in Kyrgyzstan. We made some dolls. They look like little aliens, but they're really supposed to be brand new babies because we had a labor and delivery class one time. And they've also got, I think, a doll that they're practicing some CPR. Now, will they ever use CPR? It's highly doubtful. And there would be people that would argue, why would you teach them that? They wanted to learn it. It developed self-efficacy. It was a simple thing to do. They certainly know the Heimlich, which anybody can use, and they have used. So whatever you do to encourage them. My favorite part, it's problem posing. And we talk about the showed question. This is sort of the real bones of it. It presents a problem, or puts meat on the bones, I guess. Present a problem to get people thinking and talking. You start with a story or a skit that clearly presents one single specific solvable problem in a clear, simple, often funny, real-life stimulating way that is true to the culture. Because what we said, all cultures have worldviews that explain health, illness, etc. And what we teach has to be true and fit them in with their culture. I love these questions. What do you see? I got to hurry a little bit because I've talked too much. What do you see? What is happening? Does this happen in our place? Why does this happen? And what will we do about it? Every lesson starts this way, and it's powerful. I love starters. And I have never been anywhere where there wasn't somebody that wanted to say, I'll be in a skit, I'll write a skit, let us write this skit, we'll do a skit. You think about it. This is the problem, so let's write a skit to talk about it. They were talking, this was last year in Kyrgyzstan, about nicotine. That is nicotine. Arena there is nicotine. They did a skit about all the gifts nicotine gives to everybody. Lung cancer, they had all amazing gifts. So the starters get the group's attention, sharpen understanding, stimulate thinking, serve as a guideline for discussion, help make an image real, help focus the problem, help analyze the problem. And they work. And I would encourage skits anytime you have an opportunity to use skits. And you learn so much when you include the people that you're teaching to make up a skit. It's so, I've learned more than I've ever taught. This is Kyrgyzstan. It was a food seminar. They're food, and I don't know what they're doing, but they're sure having fun. Everybody can get involved. Everybody. Everybody can do it. So everybody gets involved. Then it's time to ask the questions. You do the skit, then you ask. You can gather in groups, or you can gather together. What did you see? Can you describe it? What's happening? What happened in that skit? Well, this nicotine, and it's horrible, and it presents all these problems. Does it happen in our place? Does it happen in this new community we live in? Does it happen in our apartment building where all of our refugees live right now? Does it happen in our displaced person camp? Does it happen on this mission field? Does it happen in this church? What is happening? Does it happen in our place? Why does it happen? And we're assuming this is a problem to be resolved. And then once we know why it happens, we're thinking and coming to terms with that, what can we do about it? And to create solutions. This type of a learning lesson plan, learning tool, learning technique, it does wonders for self-discovery. I love to watch faces when they light up. And I love it when I get an epiphany by listening to other people. Learners discover self-worth when taken seriously. They share. They learn to share their thoughts. Through sharing their thoughts, they discover within themselves a good part of the answer to the problem. Because all people have some knowledge. And we want to build on what they already know. Always we want to do that. Most of the desired knowledge will come from the group and usually from individuals, different individuals, not just one person. And you have to sometimes work on that, depending upon the culture and how they talk. And when you have a class, you've already studied the culture, so you know you won't be upset if nobody says much or if one person takes over. You just learn those things. You're prepared. Incorrect questions. Incorrect answers are made more acceptable by the facilitator by just rephrasing the question or asking the group what they think. As much as possible, the facilitator facilitates instead of just presenting information. And the right answer usually does come from the group. And it's action-oriented. This is the best. This is China, where they have to be very careful what they do, but they do it. Because without action, learning is only head knowledge, right? I could tell you 1,000 times why I should only have 5 ounces of wine. And probably not even that every night. But I will share with you and be honest that I drink one very, probably 7 or 8 ounce glass of wine in the evening. And sometimes I have 2. And I know what the literature says. Not every night, guys, but I do that. So without action, learning is only head knowledge. Good teaching is helping people learn to do something. That something is to solve the specific problem that was posed in the lesson. And the lesson is not ever complete until learners have made plans for it, for acting out on that by who, where, when, how. And that's why to take a simple part. Say you want to talk to somebody about how to prevent diabetes, how to stop it, a wellness class. You don't want to take every possible way that you can stop diabetes. One particular problem that if it's focused on, and some action can be taken, and people can learn from that and use that in their families and then show other people how to use it and see results. It works. It's slow, but it works. And finally, the La Paz teaching technique is Holy Spirit guided. And I'm talking to you. You know this. Because it's only the Holy Spirit that changes lives, and only He alone that can produce changes in our hearts. And the role of our role as a facilitator is just to be sensitive and spirit-led, and we do that with our prayer and our own time with God and sharing together. So we're looking for all these things. You can read that. I've got to agree on here. We're looking for all those kind of things to happen because congregations want to work in the harvest fields. I know they do, and community health education, CHE, is one tool for harvesting. We have an opportunity to get, you are able to get a free, it's a wonderful manual. It's called Health Education Program for Developing Countries, the Most Important Knowledge. It has got some lesson plans. It's got models. It's good for adapting here. It's good for immigrants and refugees to come. And Dr. Arnold Gorski, a fellow Lutheran, a brother in Christ, said that if you email him at this address with your mail address, he will send you free this manual. And in this manual, you'll find all sorts of information about how to access a few lesson plans. I can't see it now, but I know that you can download the lesson plan model that's on this webinar. And I'm available. I am available for you at any time. I'm going to be out of town for a week. I think that I'm available, but I really am available even then. And you can email me. My telephone number is on lim.org website. Our email address is simple. If you got a pencil, Tim, TimRitaNickel, TimRitaNickel@gmail.com. I will answer your questions. If you want to work, if you think, boy, God, is, I think this is good. I want to, what can we do in our congregation? Lim will help you in any way we can. I will help you. This is my vision. This is my dream. I thank you so very, very much for listening. God bless you all. I feel like a president when I say God bless us. God bless the United States of America. Thank you, folks. Marcy, take it. Marcy? Are you there? Is anybody there?
I'm here. I'm going to go ahead and
Okay. Yeah. Is Marcy going to call?